Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
Welcome to DC Signal to Noise. On this Friday, I'm John Harith, along with Jim Weeks, my performance policy analyst, and Annalisa Laca, a policy writer for agweb.com, as well as the editor for Farm Journal's Milk. And let's get right to it, because there's a lot to get to, starting with CFAP. As we talked last week, the latest coronavirus aid package for agriculture, we've been waiting to see what the rules are for that. And Jim, you reported earlier this week that it sits in the hands of the Office of Management and Budget. As we sit here this Friday afternoon, we could see a report out, I guess, at any minute.
Yes, as soon as today, but if not early next week, because Office of Management and Budget staffers, as we said, I think last week, have been working with the USDA all this time on it. So it's not a surprise to them. And we had some indications by Secretary Sonny Perdue in another interview this week that he said they would alter the payment cap under that from the leaked levels out on it. He didn't say what they were, but most sources are signaling a double of those payment caps, and that still won't please many who think that there should be no payment cap for those payouts.
Well, Annalisa, so that's at least some welcome progress for your dairy producers.
Yeah, it's progress, and for a lot of producers, it will be. I mean, $250 is certainly much more helpful than $125,000. And Jim, you know, you mentioned that there's going to be some people who think that there still shouldn't be limits, but that's not really a reality. I mean, we could burn up the allotted amount of money very quickly with no limit at all.
Well, yeah, and that's really the case here. You could take the limits away or move them as much as you want, but there is still a limit with the amount of funding that's available in the entire program.
Yeah, well, they could always adjust that by saying they could tap into that, you know, $14 billion coming available in July.
Yeah, and that's the additional funding through the commodity credit, or the additional borrowing power, I guess, through the Commodity Credit Corporation that becomes available July 1.
Yes.
And then there could be additional money even beyond that if we can get another coronavirus aid package through Congress, right, Jim?
Yes, and although it looks like it's going to take longer than the prior ones, you will have another, whatever you want to call it, Phase 4 or CARES 2 package, and it will include some agriculture features for sure, John.
Farm Bureau is pushing for in the neighborhood of $68 billion in borrowing authority for the Commodity Credit Corporation. Does that have legs at all?
Well, I think it has some legs, and I applaud Farm Bureau for the first one to, you know, push for that. You saw that both Senator John Hoeven, Republican from North Dakota, chairman of the Senate Ag Appropriations Subcommittee, and USDA Secretary Perdue pushed for an increase in the current $30 billion borrowing authority for CCC to $50 billion. But at that time, the Democrats pushed back, only allowing a replenishment of $14 billion, keeping the $30 billion cap. Bottom line, the high odds will have an increase. I think the push is really going to be for the $50 billion level. I can't rule out the $68 billion. And I think the significance of this coming increase in the CCC, I mentioned it on AgriTalk, and I got a number of emails, intriguing emails from people who hadn't thought it through. This could make that CCC, from a farm policy perspective, John and Anna, like a pseudo Federal Reserve, in which they would be far more flexible in dealing with surprises, disaster, etc. So I think I think we may be struck on a funding mechanism for the future, in that hopefully we will not have to have a farm bill every 4 to 5 years, that in concert with the House and Senate Ag Committee and their members working together with USDA, maybe they can channel through a far more flexible farm policy that doesn't have to be written after so many years.
But that notion has drawn the ire of Colin Peterson, chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, because USDA, in his view, has had too much free rein in the CCC money that's there through MFP and now through CFAP. He really wants to see some constraints on CCC if they put more money in there.
Well, I don't blame him to a certain degree. But again, if you would tell Colin, and I think any Republican chairman of the Ag Committee, if you could have that much more money, okay, to tap, and then working with the administration, the Secretary of Agriculture, to come off on with stipulations on the use of that money, I don't think Colin would disagree with that. He just thinks it shouldn't be one-ended, because obviously there is some politics involved in if you just leave the current administration willy-nilly to tap what's been frequently called USDA's ATM machine.
Well, and in fact, the Democrats have said they are going to introduce their own aid bill, the Phase 4 version of an aid bill that has been deemed or termed possibly even more impactful than a farm bill.
Well, I kind of like that moniker. I probably won't like a lot of the provisions in it, but at least it tells you that it's going to be a show-me bill, a show bill, and the Republicans will counter. But again, I like the concept where I think it will be as important, if not more important, than the farm bill. I think it's foolery now to think that a farm bill can provide the flexibility for 4 or 5 years of agriculture in the world we live in today. So again, let the debate begin. And I want to emphasize, I do think that USDA and any administration, whether it's a Republican or Democratic, should have stipulations on how CCC funding is used. And that's why I think Colin's idea is a good one, to increase the borrowing authority and to finally have a funding mechanism, if Congress will go along with it, for the future that will give us more room to breathe in this very changing world of agriculture.
Alisa, how do you think that notion gets received in farm country, moving away from a structured farm bill to a more flexible CCC program that gives Congress additional oversight?
You know, I don't know, because there's obviously some, so one of the restrictions, right, of having a five-year farm bill, right, Jim?
4 or 5 years. It varies throughout the years. Yeah, I'm on my, was my 10th farm bill, so I've seen it all from 3 to 5 years.
Sometimes they go 6 or 7, depends on how long it takes them to pass it. Yeah,
absolutely.
I don't want to think about how much bourbon's involved in covering 10 farm bills. But so one of the constraints, right, is that oftentimes when you enroll in these programs, you're enrolled for the life of the farm bill. So I think some flexibility to enroll in programs from year to year, or to change your enrollment, or to be able to update your production history from year to year, I think all of that would be welcomed. I'm not sure about the uncertainty that could cause in terms of, you know, programs being funded 1 year and not funded the next. So I think that there's, you could definitely argue it either way, I think.
Yeah, I think there would be a baseline program. This would primarily be used for instances, as Colin said before, never again does he want an emergency situation to come up like COVID-19, and they don't have the necessary tools to deal with it. So I think that's his concept. I want to merge the significant increase in borrowing authority to hopefully not have the need for a major rewrite of the Farm Bill ever after so many years. That doesn't mean you couldn't have a mini Farm Bill, et cetera. And there would be a baseline of farmer safety net, so farmers should not and would not be concerned that the rug was going to be pulled out from them. I just think it's a time to debate this concept.
Well, and Jim, I mean, you know how it goes. Every time we pass a farm bill, it is declared that we finally have a proper safety net in place that farmers won't have to keep coming back to Congress for specific appropriations, and it never works that way. This could certainly allow USDA and the Ag committees the flexibility to respond to those situations without having to go through like what we're having to now do now with the COVID aid bills.
Well, yeah, even though the Agriculture Committee chairman and chairwomen, ranking members, said that at the time of the last Farm Bill, I didn't. I knew we would be in problems. And remember a few Farm Bills back when Frank Lucas, who was the House Ag Committee chairman, tried to warn the agriculture community and farm state lawmakers, heed my word, that if you don't bump up the price loss coverage program, PLC, if prices go very low, you're going to see the safety net wanting. And he was exactly correct.
One problem I can see in this is, and it's similar to Colin Peterson's concern, is that you are putting a great deal of power in the hands of the USDA secretary. Now, that may not be all bad, but you never know who the USDA secretary is going to be. And you also open things up to, as we have seen with MFP 2.0, we saw news from analysis from K-State this week saying that cotton got 32 times the actual injury that they suffered in the MFP program. And, of course, that leads people to say, oh, well, Sonny produced from Georgia. So, of course, cotton sees an outsized benefit. Whether it's valid or true or not, you always face those kinds of criticisms because no matter what you do, an ag secretary is going to come from a certain geography.
Well, if you're hearing me correctly, the signal I am giving is that I think it is the time for Congress to take back some of their authority relative to the Commodity Credit Corporation and put stipulations on it. I do not want any Secretary of Agriculture, again, be they Republican or Democratic administration, to have the almost complete flexibility they have now with the use of that funding. So in this area, I agree with Colin Peterson. He wants to get back control to what he calls the farm policy experts in Congress.
All right. So again, this is all contingent on a new COVID aid package making it through, as we've talked the last couple of weeks. This everything under the sun is getting thrown onto this, from aid to the states. More business aid, infrastructure, you name it, it's being thrown into this potential package. Is Congress going to be able to whittle it down to a light enough weight that it can make it out?
They're going to have to. But you got to remember, both parties like to spend money nowadays. So to me, it's not a question of if we have another package, either called Phase 4 or CARES 2. It's to what degree, both from a funding level and what's in it. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will go as long as she possibly can to the point in which she thinks she has extracted as much as she can from the White House on what she and her Democratic colleagues want. From the Republican side, they're going to have red lines in this proposal. And there's already differences between the White House and Senate Republicans on what they want. So, I think they're going to have to whittle down because everybody's putting out proposals. Mm-hmm. And because lawmakers know, John, and farm groups know, this could be the last train leaving as far as this multi-billion or trillion-dollar aid package. Another reason why you might want to boost the Commodity Credit Corporation borrowing authority, sooner or later, we're going to have to deal with the budget debt, the budget deficit than debt. I'd much rather have that CCC borrowing authority as high as possible, because agriculture is not going to escape the budget cuts in the years ahead. Not right now, of course, but that would be another element I would want to have something out there, pretty high.
Piggy bank off to the side?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Let's move on to China. We've seen a bit of a split personality from President Trump over the last couple of weeks about China. On the one hand, taking a very serious charge against them on coronavirus issues, while at the same time seeming to kind of foster the phase one implementation. Where's the signal really lying here, Jim?
Well, the signal lies in typical Trump. When you're some of the numbers, because of the jobless numbers, the unemployment rate going higher, the economy, you're going to be down close to 40% in the second quarter on GDP. It's classic Trump 101 to divert attention into other topics. And this one's China, especially when you have both political parties agreeing that we should take China on relative to what apparently they didn't do regarding information in the early days and weeks of the COVID-19. Thursday, depending on how you say it, China's time, it was today, but U.S. time, it was last night, is the U.S. and Chinese trade officials at the highest level talked. And the spins coming out of that from both China and the U.S., by the way, that was progress. What was the rule that phase one showed some progress. So that's why, in part, we had the rally today in the equities market and still having. However, once again, Trump 101, he appeared on the Fox and Friends show today, and he offered much less optimistic comments about China and the fate of the phase one trade pact. Yeah, it's just this yin and yang that he has. So it's frustrating. But I've always said, go with Lighthizer. And with Lighthizer and the Chinese both saying, okay, they've made some progress. And you don't throw phase one out on the first quarter of a two-year agreement. I mean, when you really think logically through this, but yet we have this Trump repeating the accusations that the Chinese government was responsible for the pandemic, and when pressed in the interview, he just offered uncertainty. His last quote was, "I'm very torn. I have not yet decided relative to China. If you want to know the truth," so he's thinking out loud there now. President should not do that.
No.
Reporters love when a president or a lawmaker thinks out loud.
And Jim, I think most of us would agree that the U.S. should be taking a close look at what China did in the early days of this pandemic and what they didn't do to control it there, and what their responsibility is. But I think where the surprise comes is when President Trump ties that to phase one. You would think that the U.S. would want to keep those completely separate so that phase one can move forward, and that there's not that you don't tie them together and increase the risk that something from COVID could mess up phase one.
Very logical. I cannot fault that. You would hope that would be the case.
But it isn't. But it isn't. It's been exactly the opposite.
And that's what's frustrating. So, but you see Trump changing frequently. You saw another case this week in which he clearly indicated he was going to disband pretty soon the task force, the COVID virus task force. And then the very next day, he pulled it back, So who knows next week at this time what verdict we're in. But I'm going to go on the positive statements from both the U.S. Trade Rep's office and the Chinese relative to phase one. If the political people advising Trump and Trump's own instincts realize that if phase one were to go asunder then you would see some negative poll numbers on how farmers and ranchers feel about President Trump. In my judgment, that would be a clear signal to farmers that, this thing is going to get worse than I thought.
But so far, your signal is that so far that notion is not wearing on the Chinese in a real sense, in that it's threatening phase one yet. Am I reading that right?
I agree with that. Okay. The signal is that China's going for the long haul. They need the commodities. They don't want to throw it out. There's advantages for both countries in this, and that's the current assessment from many of our people here in Washington, sources and China watchers at this time.
I mentioned the record jobless rates announced today. What is this going to mean for agriculture? I mean, there's both a labor component to this and a demand component, in that SNAP demand, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program demand, is going to be at record levels, as well as other food programs. So what should those in ag be watching in these numbers?
Well, this bolsters the case of one of the requirements that Speaker Pelosi has said, that it's going to be a significant increase in SNAP or food stamp funding. I think that's a given right now, and they can utilize some of the numbers that we had today. Frankly, the numbers were actually positive for the stock market, because although close to 15%, they weren't at the 17 to 19% floated by some of these frequently quoted investment analysts in the East.
Yeah, that just amazed me this morning. But I'm glad it ended up that way, but my word. Annalisa, what are you seeing out in Nevada and on your farm as far as the labor market? Is this high unemployment changing the landscape for you?
No.
Really?
I mean, let me be real frank. We cannot afford to pay anybody $950 a week for an entrance-level position, period. That's a lot of money. People are making a lot of money on unemployment right now. I mean, it's the point where we have some cousins who own a coffee shop in Reno, and they laid off their employees because they were asked to close by the governor, and they're now allowed to reopen, but they can't get their employees back because people do not want to work for less money than what they're making on unemployment. It's a significant problem, and I don't know how we fix it, but I can tell you that, at least from our perspective, at this point, record unemployment's not helping anything.
Wow.
And go back to the debate on this. Some Republicans at the time pointed out that this would be a problem once we got Americans hopefully going back to work. And then Senator Dick Durbin, from a farm belt state of Illinois, of which I was born and raised in, I'll never forget, on the floor of the Senate, when he was challenged, saying that this would be a problem bringing people back to work because of what Annalisa just said, he said, "What's wrong with giving people more money?" I think the farmers in Illinois should point out to him, this is what's wrong with that. Not saying that those workers should not have gotten the money, but not to the degree that they received, that there were other ways to get aid to them.
Well, yeah, not to the point that it de-incentivizes going back to work.
Yes.
Well, and you know, when you think about hiring an entrance-level employee at $950 a week is almost $55,000 a year. Then I have to increase salaries for everybody else on my team relative to how long they've been there and what their tenure is. So it's not only going to increase, you know, our payroll expense by whatever the difference is, which is about, our starting employees make about $35,000 a year. But it's going to increase that amount over every single employee at the percentage of which we have to increase that base salary. It's a lot of money. It's a significant issue.
But there are things coming out of this that I'm getting a signal from, John, for the future, and that is hazard pay for the future. Mm-hmm. If you're working, and in this case, meatpacking plants, et cetera, grocery stores, if you're working in an industry that we now have proven that it could be detrimental to your health under certain situations, and it's a strategic industry. Perhaps there should be variable minimum wages by type of job. I think that's going to be a debate you're going to see unfold in the months and years ahead.
And probably a very worthy debate.
Yes.
Well, and another problem I can foresee with this is, rather than having a phased reentry of the workforce, as we had probably foreseen, if it's all dependent on those benefits ending, that it's going to be everybody washing back into the workforce at once and probably creating a certain degree of havoc.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing so far is it's going to be a rolling in, because there are a number of, I can even see it here, to where in Virginia, where the people, even if you can open up, a number of businesses are not going to open up until for a variety of reasons. They may want a little more safety out there, or two, because of the employment payment problems that we've already discussed and other aspects, and until they feel enough people are going to come out and go to their enterprise businesses. I think a couple of things to watch out for the future, the signals that listeners should watch, and you're seeing the beginning of it, where a combination of increased gasoline consumption, mm-hmm. although limited right now, is showing increases, and I would chart that now, because that will be a litmus test on how many people are coming out. Two, the price of gasoline is going up, not significantly, but that's in tandem, I think. And three, for the future, at least when the ag sector is involved, I think the Federal Reserve, you'll recall that they come out with a report called the Beige Book. That's going to become very important, because the Federal Reserve system kind of gets the tenor out there of what's happening in each state. And that's going to become, and they talk to bankers, et cetera, and that's going to become more and more important as we go on to monitor those Beige reports of what they say regionally, because it's going to vary in farm country, and what the ag bankers are telling lawmakers, because they see the bottom line in books. In a number of cases in the meat industry, we're seeing some companies back off of basis contracts, et cetera, that had been established, locked in by a number. In this case, I've got an email from a hog producer where he had a really good basis out a few months, and the company he dealt with, I won't mention, is backing out of it. You're going to see that in the future being looked at, because that's a sham as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I think you will see some increased protections in some of those contracts because of what we're seeing here. And again, I mean, everybody's in a bad spot on this, but it's really the producer that's getting squeezed on both sides on this right now.
Yes. This is going to have so much information to research for the future. But right now we're in the crisis situation. And I know most in Congress wanted to err on the giving side at the beginning. But now we can adjust it to with the focus on getting people back to work. So it's going to have to significantly modified from a CARES One package.
You talked about the packing plants. We have seen some good news there in that capacity has gone up slightly this week, Jim.
Yes, and USDA put out a statement today that it said 14, quote, major meat packing facilities are reopening this week. And then they listed them. And I noticed they also had Tyson, Dakota City, Nebraska on the beef side. Now on AgriTalk, I mentioned a thing that caught my ire, and we might want to have, I'll try to get Senator Hovind on for next week, but the Nebraska papers and TV channels were pointing out the last few days that the Nebraska state issued a gag order, is the way they put it, hours before rumors of COVID-19 prevalence at Nebraska City. Now, Governor Pete Ricketts announced that state health workers would no longer be able to report COVID-19 data from meat processors. Why?
Yeah,
he said it was for it's a matter of privacy. I gotta have time to dig into that. That doesn't smell good to me.
No, it doesn't, because you're not identifying any individuals. You're just saying in aggregate what the impact is, and the public, the other workers at that plant, all have a need to know that in knowing how to manage their own potential exposure.
Well, absolutely. Even in the supermarket areas, we have, I know in Virginia, we have certain ones that we know how many tracebacks they have to COVID-19, and you can see some hot spots. Well, you won't want to go to that supermarket.
Right.
But if you don't have transparency, you don't even know that. So again, there may be a better explanation of this, and we will get into it. But I don't have it right now, and that raised a red flag to me on lack of transparency. He's well liked in Nebraska. I've met him personally. I've been at Pete Ricketts, Governor's Ag Conference. So maybe we can get him on the program. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll have to try that and see if we can get a response.
Sure.
From him. Lisa, in this meatpacking issue, we've talked and heard a lot about the impact on the hog industry, on the beef industry. But what about dairy? How is this impacting culling cows for the dairy industry?
You know, cool cow prices were at, we could debate them to be record lows. I mean, my brother-in-law sold a load of cows for 30 cents.
Wow.
Which is frighteningly low before the shutdown of the packing plant.
Really?
So I have not seen sale numbers to know. I do know that that was not just a regional thing, and that we got similar reports out of Wisconsin too. I think a couple of farmers that I talked to there said they got 35 cents, which is still not anywhere near normal. So I can imagine that there was a significant impact. You know, the JBS plant in Green Bay was down for about a week, and that's where we put most of the cool cows in Wisconsin through. So I think it's safe to say that there was an impact and will be a long-term impact. I just don't think we're real clear on what that is yet.
John, this just in, Trump taking strong precautions at the White House on testing. Vice President Mike Pence tested negative today.
Okay, yeah, because we had the news earlier today that one of the vice president's aides has tested positive. That's after the news yesterday that one of the president's valets has tested positive. So that's two cases there very close to the White House and even inside the White House. Annalise, we know, getting back to the coal cow situation, we know that the window for hog producers moving those hogs is very, very tight. It's a little broader for beef cattle. And I imagine you've got a fair amount of flexibility for dairy cattle. What does that look like?
You have some flexibility. So often when we're culling cows, like in the amount that we are now, it's to reduce our milk production. Those cows typically are going to be, I mean, it's the farmer's decision, right? But typically it's going to be cows that are later in lactation, but they're still going to be producing milk. So we don't have a whole lot of flexibility to hang on to them without milking them. That causes a host of metabolic and, you know, animal health issues. But we do have some flexibility to keep them. We have some flexibility, but not a whole lot. I mean, we run into an abundance of issues when we try to feed cows without milking them that are in lactation. So I think for a lot of farmers, I mean, that's why if you're going to get rid of them, they just have to go, and you're going to take a bath in that price if you have to, but not a whole lot of flexibility to hang on to them.
That's interesting. Well, again, though, I think, and this is directed to both of you, I guess I'll start with you, Annalisa. Given everything we've seen in recent weeks, this week just felt like the sun was starting to open up a little bit. That increased capacity that we're seeing in the slaughter plants was part of it. I think the actual sunshine and warmer temperatures that we've seen has driven some of that. And I think, you know, some of the states starting to relax some of the measures is playing into that. And did you get the same sense this week that maybe there was just a little bit of sunshine coming in from some of the darkness that we've seen in the past 7 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think so. And I think a lot of that has to do with we're starting to see states like Nevada will restart our economy on Saturday. We're starting to see more of that happen. And we saw the stock market respond positively to all of that. So, I mean, I think that always helps. I think you're right that the weather helps. I mean, I think that there's just a host of things that have made this week feel more hopeful. And I hope that that will continue into next week.
What about you, Jim? Do we have sunshine and cherry blossoms in D.C.?
Well, you have some. China bought a big chunk of corn and some other commodities this week. That's always good. This could be the beginning. Our China watchers say this is just the beginning of their pretty hefty coming China buys. You also had the announcement from a sports perspective, the entire NFL season calendar came out. You had reports that baseball spring training will be in middle of June, and then they'll start up in July, right around the time of, you know, 4th of July. And that's not a negative to me at all. So, yeah, and I think groups like the Beef Alliance, who came out with a proposal on a beef.
Oh, yeah, we forgot to get to that, yeah.
I want to blend this in. With their beef, their, you know, fed beef set-aside, gives me encouragement that the way it should be in America, commodity groups can help themselves come up with innovative programs. And it's basically, to be very brief on it, a 75-day governor's program of maintenance diet.
Yeah, okay. Is that getting traction?
Well, it's getting talked about. I don't know. I haven't looked at the wires, if you will. I'm curious to see what the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is going to come out on this one, whether they're going to support it or whether they will reject it. So I'm waiting on that. I will tell you that my doctor has wanted to put me on a maintenance diet for decades, and I can't follow it.
I feel your pain, Jim. I feel your pain. All right. Well, as we do every week, let's wrap up with where we're watching for signal this coming week. Jim, we'll give you the start this week.
Oh, USDA's May WASDE report. That gives us their first projections of the new crop, both acres, yield, demand, et cetera. So that's going to be a biggie.
And maybe a peek into what USDA is thinking about China, too.
Absolutely.
All right, that comes out on Tuesday. Annalisa Lacco, where are you watching for signal this week?
So USDA announced today that they're going to that they have selected a bid for their Farmers to Families Food Box program. That's the program that they're going to use to distribute that those dairy products and other food items to food banks through the CARES Act. So I'm looking to see who those distributors are and when they actually get that program moving.
One thing, the number of farm state senators, both political parties, wrote the president basically more than urging him not to approve any waivers for the renewable fuel standard program. Now, today, oil refiners said the letter from those corn state lawmakers to Trump regarding those no waivers proves why the EPA should grant the governor's waivers request. Quote, the letter concedes that 46% of the capacity has been idled during the current crisis. The group said if the biofuel requirements are still held steady, they said, the RFS will simply be converted into an import mandate, the coalition said.
Well, and there is something to be said for that, given the processing capacity that's there right now. That'll be interesting to watch in coming weeks. The other place to watch for signal this week is hopefully early next week we will see those rules from USDA on the COVID aid package, and that'll be a big note to follow. Hopefully we'll have details for you in next week's.
Yes.
All right. Well, Annalisa Lacco, Jim Wiesmeyer, thanks so much for the information this week. We'll talk to you again next Friday. DC, Signal to Noise.